Hello and welcome again to another episode of Sacktown Talks. Today we have a special guest joining us, Assemblymember Tom Lackey. Tom, thanks for joining us. Welcome to the program.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Yeah, how's it going today?
Today was a pretty simple day. We had a very, very quick floor exercise, and I've had several Zoom meetings, and here we are.
Yeah, are you in the district, or are you still in the Capitol office?
No, I'm at the Capitol. At the swing space, right?
Yeah, so how are you enjoying that new swing space?
I think the swing space is great. I know there's a lot to be said about the security, a lot of frustration by some of the members, but I find it to be just fine. And I'm thankful for security, truthfully.
Thanks for reviews, yeah.
And it's a lot more open than the Capitol was. And, you know, this is supposed to be the people's place, and I think it's more inviting in this environment. People right. have to travel a distance to come here to visit us often. And I think this is a lot more welcoming.
Yeah. So Tom, you were originally elected in 2014. Is that right?
Yes, sir.
And so you're heading into what, 18, 19, 20, what is this, your eighth year?
It is.
Wow. You know, it's kind of a weird phenomenon that's going on, you know, around the country, and especially here in the legislature, is what, you know, we have 27, 28 assembly members deciding not to run again. Kind of, what's your sense over there? Kind of, why do you think kind of members are leaving and not coming back to seek, you know, those final terms?
Yeah, everybody has their own individual circumstance, right? Even though there's a certain common thread for all of us, there's 80 members. So that's a pretty large group of people, and they all have individual circumstances, and redistricting changed a lot. And so because of that dynamic, it's caused a lot of decision-making that I think that was even unexpected.
Right. And so you don't think there's something that they know that they're seeing that, you know, we don't see here on the
Well, there's also the political dynamic is also changing for sure. There's COVID impacted a lot of things, and it caused people's behavior to be impacted.
Right.
And I think also a lot of the legislative decisions have proven to be have negative outcomes. And so I think a lot of people are seeing that, and it's impacting political decisions.
Yeah. Kind of, as you noted, redistricting just happened. Kind of, how's your new district look, and kind of how's redistricting affecting you?
Well, prior to this redistricting situation, I've represented a Democratic seat. It's been plus 11. There's only been, there's under 30% Republican registration in the district I've represented.
Wow.
So I've been the underdog every election I undertake. And as a matter of fact, the primary opponent that I've always faced, I should say, the general opponent I've faced is the guy that I removed from office in 2014. He's come back every time, and he's provided quite an interesting challenge. And so we've prevailed every time. It doesn't matter the margin, right? As long as right. you're here, it doesn't matter the margin that you win by. And the new district lines will make this a safe Republican seat, but I have to run against another colleague that is also from my party. So that creates an awkward circumstance, but nonetheless, we'll move forward.
Right. So you actually have to run against another sitting member of the Republican.
I do.
Right? Wow.
He's a freshman member, but nonetheless, he's a member.
Right. And so that, you know, creates, I guess, challenges kind of back.
No, it does create challenges. And especially the new district lines, he has a larger portion. He retained a larger portion of the district. He's about 52% and I'm about 39%.
Right.
And there's about 10% from other districts.
Yeah. So kind of, you know, I guess being a Republican member and kind of being in the minority, the super
How about
minority,
the super minority?
Yeah, exactly. The super minority. Kind of, how have you found it being, you know, able to kind of get some of your legislation done here in the Capitol?
Well, I think everybody has their own story, right? And I feel like I have my own story. I never imagined myself to be a legislator ever. But I got involved in local leadership, was on a school board, and then I was on a city council, and I was recruited to both. And I'm not sure exactly why, other than my life experience. I was a special ed teacher before I was a highway patrolman. My degree's in special education, and so I have a very big investment and interest in the developmentally disabled community. But law enforcement was a great career for me. I wanted it since I was in high school. particularly the highway patrol. And that's why I pursued a special ed degree, because I didn't want general law enforcement. The mission of the highway patrol fit me. And if I didn't get them, then I wasn't going to be in law enforcement. But it all worked out very nicely. And I believe my life experience is what makes me unique to the legislature and allows me to have impact, even though I'm of the super minority party.
Right. And, you know, kind of coming up, we've just had, you know, the bill introduction deadline pass coming up in the committee season. Kind of, I go, what are some of your legislative priorities this year? And kind of what are you working on right now going into committee season?
Well, one of our biggest priorities is what we're calling Gabriel's Law. I don't know if you know the story. There was been movies actually done on Netflix, a series about Gabriel Fernandez, who tragically lost his life from severe child abuse that amounted to torture, actually. And this case has had such a profound impact on our community. We've also had two others fall in the same circumstance. They also lost their lives as young children in this kind of set of circumstances where they have caregivers that abuse them. And so we're taking this on as best we can. This whole child abuse situation is very, very tragic, and it continues to be a big deal. We have over 100 children lose their lives every year.
Wow.
Under what is supposed to be, you know, a loving environment, and it clearly is everything but that. And so we have some legislation to try to address that particular problem. So that's called Assembly Bill 2654, and it establishes a state child death review council that we're one of the only states in the country that don't have this. And so we believe that this is an important aspect that will bring attention to this problem, hopefully, and prevent some of these ridiculous tragedies. We also have another bill. It's the Mental Health Preschool Services Act, AB 2281. And it prioritizes mental health of young children, specifically the 0-5 population. And it enables the Mental Health Services Oversight and Accountability Commission to fund partnerships between mental health entities and preschool daycare programs. There's been a lot that's happened because of this pandemic situation, and it's impacted development in a very serious way. And a lot of them are circumstances that no other generations had to deal with. And so we want to make sure that they're getting that support. And it's because early child development is so pivotal to later development. And yeah. So we want to make sure that we're offering the services that this population deserves. And we believe that this will help that to take place. I have several other bills, but I don't want to bore you. I have passion about all of them. Our bill package is about 10. We have about 10 particular bills, we believe that they're all important aspects, or we wouldn't do them.
Right.
But I will tell you that as a Republican, when you're in the super minority, your contributions don't only come through bills, right? Unfortunately. You serve on several committees, and I have several committees that I serve on that I'm very, very proud of, mostly the Public Safety Committee, which I'm vice chair, and also local government. Those are really powerful committees that I believe my life experience gives me good credibility.
Right.
And so I have the ability to vet circumstances and to bring shaping circumstances to a lot of these proposed bills. And I think that's a big contribution, but probably the biggest contribution that I feel that our office has always provided is our, what they call constituent services, and especially through COVID when we had EDD that was so dysfunctional. I mean, you had people that had such tragic stories that were calling our office, and we were their only lifeline because there was no way that they could even reach government. That system was so overloaded and so mismanaged that they couldn't even get someone to talk to. And they had no money coming in, and they had been laid off because of COVID, and they were very destitute, many of them. And right. So we felt like we were their ear, and we were able to get, in most cases, you know, sometimes they still had to wait a ridiculous amount of time, but we at least were someone that was working on their problem. And that brought at least some solace to them. And I believe the constituent services is a very critical aspect of what legislators provide.
You know, that's a unique thing you brought up. You know, with the assembly, there's 80 different people. You guys have, you know, 80 different backgrounds sometimes, and kind of you have a unique background, kind of with your kind of special education background and your background as a highway patrol officer. Kind of, how do you use that when analyzing bills or kind of, you know, looking at legislation?
Yeah, I will tell you that one of the things that it afforded me is kind of having a better understanding of the differences in our society, right? I've worked in an urban environment, I've worked in suburban environment and rural environments, and the cultures are different in all three. And I will tell you that it's important to kind of understand and relate to the entire state. I know a lot of times there are people that come from a district that are very, very universal. I mean, it's all city or it's all rural or it's all suburban. I have a very mixed district. I don't really have an urban part of my district, but I do have a significantly suburban. And I think when this legislative proposals come forward, it's important to consider the entire population of California, which is very, very diverse, not only in color and not only in age and a lot of the common categories that people are put in, but also demographically by population. And I believe that in all categories, I've dealt with pretty much the entire population of California, both from the very wealthy to the very struggling, and also different racial groups, all of them. I've dealt with all of them. I've worked, as I said, Central Los Angeles. I've worked also at suburban El Cajon and San Diego area, and also the Antelope Valley. And I feel like that gives me a grounding that many legislators have not been able to experience.
You know, Tom, I know you're part of the bipartisan Problem Solvers Caucus. Can you kind of tell us a little bit about your involvement in the Problem Solvers Caucus and kind of some of the things you're working on with the caucus?
Yeah, we're very new. We're very new and very proud to be part of this important bicameral, bipartisan group of thinkers, because of the district that I've represented, I've had to be that way, right? I've had to be a Republican that represented a Democrat district. So that means once you're elected, it doesn't matter who voted for you, right? You represent that entire district. And so it's important that you sometimes go outside your general line of thinking. And I think I've proven that. And I think that's why I was invited to join the group, the initial group of legislators. And what we're doing is we're trying to subvert some of the political influences that sometimes serve as impediments to good ideas. And so we're going straight to the chase. For example, one of the things that we're working on, I don't even know if I'm supposed to talk about these things because it's kind of like super secret, right? But there's an energy, I'll be broad. There's an energy component that we're working very, very diligently on that I think the public is going to be very excited. And it's going to be very refreshing. And I think it has a chance to penetrate and be very successful in addressing these energy challenges that, especially right now with this Russian influence that's right, so deplorable, it's really impacting our energy challenge. And, you know, with the desire to be heavily focused on environmental concerns, I think there's a balance that can be drawn. And we think we've got a great suggestion to move towards a kind of a compromise situation that addresses both the environment and the energy circumstances. So we're very excited. I would get pounded if I released the super secret discussion points, because here's the cool thing about this group though. We have all sworn to what's talked about in the room stays in the room.
Right.
Right. Because there's some influences that they're not really excited about us. And I'll just say that, right? There's some people that are threatened by our very existence, and that's unfortunate, but it's also to be predicted. And so sometimes it's very important how we release information as well as the information we release. So, And we're also working on the difficulty of our medical services and how that's being wrestled with, right? I mean, this whole, you saw the beginning of the year, there was this big energy to push socialized medicine, for lack of a better term, right? I mean, it took off, and thank heavens it didn't move any more in that direction, because that's not the answer, in my opinion, I think in the opinion of most people. But nonetheless, it's this this group of thinkers are people that have guts, and they also have great heart for, I think, for the general good. And they're not caught in partisan pressures. And I think that that's helpful. And we kind of patterned ourselves that there is a problem solvers group in Washington, D.C., and we're going to go meet with them in just a few months and kind of learn from them and how they operate. But it's refreshing and it's exciting.
Yeah, there's some a lot of challenges out there to tackle that.
Yeah, we're not short on problems, but right. One of the really difficult circumstances that the legislature wrestles with that I wish that we did differently. I wish that we would just focus on like the top five problems, and we can't talk about anything else until we have solutions for those five problems. I mean, we all know, you know, homelessness is one of the biggest problems, this energy situation. Let's take them bit by bit. And but everybody wants to dance around the big problems and, you know, kind of just talk about it, and the problems grow. And it's unfortunate.
Well, you know, kind of that brings me to my next question. You know, we got this $60 billion budget surplus. You know, you think you could solve a lot of problems with $60 billion. Kind of what are your thoughts about what we should do with that money and how we should spend it?
Yeah, I mean, every constituency in the world feels like that, you know, they're entitled to that money. And I think that, you know, we should tackle the biggest problems that we have and use some of that funding to address some of those really dynamic problems. Energy being the big one right now. I mean, this whole war is impacting everybody. You know, there's also workforce shortages that need to be addressed, that entrance level jobs, employers are having a hard time filling those jobs because there's not a real huge incentive when you're getting benefits for staying at home. Right. Who wants to go work for the same price, right? I don't think there's a big incentive there to do that. And so that's one of the difficulties that I think government and people in public policy are trying to address. And it's very challenging. But as far as the surplus, there's plenty of problems to go around. And the problem is it's one-time funding, right? And so you can't really address it in a way that's ongoing, because you can't. I think the economy, as you know, is very cyclical. It's a very sawtooth situation. All you have to do is look at history, and that's just how it rolls. And we've had successes for quite a period of time.
Yeah, and it's been amazing. Every year it gets bigger and bigger, the budget surplus. You know, you think, wow, that was amazing last year. And you're like, wow.
It is amazing, especially with COVID, right? It's like, what? How did that happen? So, yeah. I just hope that we'll be judicious, right? And there's some that we should be saving of that, a significant portion, in my opinion, because we know that difficulties lie ahead. So why wouldn't we save as much as we absolutely can? Of course, we have legislation that forces us to. Thank heavens for Governor Brown. And I don't say that often, but that's certainly one of the things that he did.
Right. You know, there's a lot of talk about, you know, suspending the gas tax or, you know, giving people some sort of rebates. You know, it's been discussed, $400 kind of. What are your thoughts on kind of how to give?
No, I think anything that we could do that's real, anything that regular people can benefit from is a great idea. Mm-hmm. Because the problems are real. I can tell you that, you know, the challenge associated with this economic challenge, and it's not just because of the war. These economic conditions existed well before the war, but they've just been exacerbated.
Right.
And so now it's become even more emergent that we actually take some action. And for example, in my community, we have almost about 80,000 commuters every day. And that commute is not 10 miles, 15 miles. It's over 100 miles round trip. So these are huge impacts on the area that I represent. And so whatever the government can do is a step in the right direction, right? Nothing is going to totally eliminate the challenge, but any step that we could take that's meaningful, that doesn't cause other problems, that's why I think that's a perfect opportunity to use these budget surpluses for this particular one-time situation, because this is the biggest crisis we've faced in my lifetime.
Yeah. You know, another issue that's kind of been big lately is the issue of crime here in the state of California. Kind of being a former law enforcement officer, kind of what do you think are some of the solutions we need to look at in order to solve some of our crime issues?
It'd be nice to actually restore accountability. I mean, that we keep focusing entirely on this rehabilitation aspect, which is a noble thing to do. However, we've done it at the expense of reason. And it's unfortunate. Prop 47 amendments are clearly in demand. And as you can see, the legislature, the Democratic side of our legislature disagrees with that. And so it's really hard. It's probably going to go to another darn initiative, and they're never the best because they don't have the same kind of vetting. But the public's very tired of not feeling safe. And a lot of it has contributed to the public policy that we've initiated in trying to relax sentencing and any kind of level of punishment. I mean, these smash and grab circumstances are clearly for you to, you have to, in order to have a felony conviction, $950? Think about how much merchandise you can get for $950. And that's a day per incident. So if you didn't think that that was going to lead to problems, you were kidding yourself. And we've seen it happen really pretty rapidly. And right. We have all these other circumstances where people just don't feel safe anymore, where even how we define what's felonious behavior and the way that we define serious felonies versus violent felonies, it's just a step in between. And it's crazy. It's what we have done. And the attempt to try to encourage rehabilitation is really just relaxed any kind of accountability for people that have bad intentions. And it's having a negative impact on our safety net. And everybody thinks because I'm in law enforcement that I'm just a lock them up, throw away the key kind of dude, but I'm not. I want something that works, right? I want everybody to rehabilitate. Why wouldn't I?
Right.
Because everybody wins on that front. Unless it's a life sentence, they're all going to come back out eventually. So why wouldn't we do everything we could to make them feel like they could be productive? I think this public safety piece is a very, very real thing. People are tired. Plus, we also had, you know, the law enforcement abusive example that came right during COVID, too, and everybody was emotionally a little bit unstable. And it was such an egregious act of irresponsibility. We had everybody turn against the police. And that also has a negative outcome, right? And we had a lot of officers that have lost their lives because you have angry people that act irrationally. And we kind of have a rebound that's actually taking place, in my opinion, where people see that, you know, that probably wasn't the best course of action to defund the police. That they really are not bad people. They're willing to die for people they have never met. So that can't be make you too evil of a person, I don't think. But nonetheless, I think that we're moving back in the right track. And I think we're becoming more stable. And I think that people are going to demand some more consequences.
You know, I guess another issue that's kind of very pervasive around the state is the issue of homelessness. And, you know, for years we've tried to grapple with this, haven't really found a solution. Kind of some, what are some of your thoughts on how to deal with homelessness here in the state of California?
Yeah, housing first approach doesn't work in our situation because the problem has gotten to be so big and so complicated. We have to also have a services balance on how we reach out to this population. And some of this, the people that are now flooding our sidewalks and different parts of our communities, they don't really want help. I mean, in their hearts, they're not going to seek help ever. So what's going to happen is there's going to have to be outreach that actually pushes them into assistance and pushes them into an environment to where they get treatment and assistance. And that's an uncomfortable place. That's an uncomfortable place to go. And so no one has really taken the initiative to do that yet. But I think it's coming. I think it's coming because we're seeing that all our other attempts, because both sides of the aisle want this to improve, right? No one is comfortable with what's happening. However, sometimes you have to go outside of your comfort zone to do what's right.
Right.
And some of these people need to be pushed into a situation to where they're going to get services and care. because they don't know how to do it on their own. And that puts everybody in an uncomfortable space on how you do that. And also the professional level of services, I don't know that we have enough professionals to go around right now to offer these services. When drug rehabilitation and mental health issues, very complicated and very unique to the individual. And so it's not an easy service to just broad blanket, right? And one size does not fit all, fits very few, truthfully. Right. And we've tried a one size fits all with this housing thing. And many of the people that are in this circumstance don't want housing. At least they don't think they do, but it's very complicated. And that's why we haven't been able to push. And this is a long, long situation that's grown over the years, over decades. And that's why it's so big now. It's really getting momentum because we have affordability issues to make it even worse.
Yeah, something you touched on a couple of times, I guess, is a lack of employees for certain kind of healthcare services jobs. Kind of, what are some of your ideas to attract more employees to that space?
Well, one of the things that I'm hoping that we will do is we will invite people from around the country and let them know it's a priority for us. And so we need to have incentives in our university system that actually lessens the cost and offer scholarships and those kind of opportunities to invite students and a servant's heart kind of individual to pursue California, and to let them know that they're in demand and that we want them, and there's going to be jobs for them when they get out of their education system. And I don't think we've been terrible at that. We have not really created that kind of environment. And I'm all for doing what we can as a legislative body to encourage that. And there is a lot we can do. And I'm hoping that we will eventually make that take place.
Wow. Well, Tom, I know you're a busy guy and you got to run, but thank you so much for joining us. And we look forward to when you can tell us about some of these great ideas you're working on with the problem solvers. Come on back and talk to us to help solve some of these issues. So thank you so much.
No, thank you for having
on.
Me. This is exciting, and Sacktown Talks is an opportunity to actually hear that we're actually just normal people.
Yep.
Legislators are just regular old people with a big responsibility.
Exactly. Well, thank you so much, Tom, and best of luck this coming year, and we'll love to catch up with you later.
Okay, we'll look forward to that.
All right. Thanks, Tom. Have a good one.
You bet. Take care.